Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. I hope your day is starting well. Thanks for listening this morning. We've got an exciting day and exciting week coming up as we start our spring share tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. So we're looking forward to that. We're all very excited. We also have kind of another fun event coming up a week from Tuesday, which is tax day. Easy day to remember because you have to file your taxes by April 17th. That morning, we're going to do a live broadcast of this exact show, yes, the Early Morning Late Show is going to be broadcasting live in studio, and you're welcome to come and be part of that. We'll have coffee, I believe, and we're only going to use the grounds once on that day. Around here, we use them more than once throughout the day, but on that day, I promise the grounds will be fresh grounds, and certain pastries and goodies, and you can be part of a little studio audience. We're going to have great live in-studio guests, and we're going to have lots of fun. And Rebecca, you're smiling like crazy, but you're not even going to be in the room.
Unfortunately, I may not be. But I hope to send a little emissary down, and maybe I can get a pastry or two.
That would be nice.
I'm just excited. This is going to be really fun. This is the first time the Early Morning Late Show has done something like this, and it's going to be really exciting to, I think, maybe... Get to see listeners in person, and they'll get to see you. And
oh, quiet down now. there is kicking and screaming for the remaining available seats. There aren't many left, but you can still say, yeah, go to the website, mm-hmm. I think, and you can fill out a little form that says, I'd like to come.
Yes, it's right on the front page. So when you go to myfaithradio.com, you'll see the note that says, join the live event for the Early Morning Late Show. And we just need a little bit of information from you and let us know that you are actually able to come. So you need to be in the Twin Cities area around about 7 a.m.
Yes.
on the 17th.
That's probably a good thing to let people know. I'll be signing books, and seeing how I haven't written any, feel free to bring any book you have from your house and I'll sign it. All right. We've got a great second hour coming up. Chris Martin's going to be with us from Lifeway Research, the millennial evangelical. You might know him as that. And then we're going to speak to David Aikman, our foreign affairs specialist and correspondent from Bray, Ireland. And I have to say, that's going to be an interesting conversation. There's a lot going on, and nobody processes that information better than David. So that's what's ahead. It's going to be a great hour, 7 minutes after. Be back in a minute. Good morning. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Seems like with every new tech advantage comes a new tech annoyance. Seems that way. I think Apple is coming out with a new car. I think it's been stalled in production, though. I think they have had some problems, but I did see a picture of it, and it is really cool looking. Have to admit, wouldn't mind having one. You know, I could pair it with my watch. Be kind of cool. I'd be nervous about getting stuck, though, on the side of the road while it updates. It's like, oh, I've got to wait for the updates. But speaking of technology, my next guest, Chris Martin, the millennial evangelical, knows a lot about all of that. And I always love talking to him about it. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I always find it interesting when we have new opportunities, how there's always going to be a downside, this now YouTube scandal, this strange allure of becoming a overnight sensation on YouTube drives a lot of people to do crazy things.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I was actually talking to some friends about it this weekend. Social media and really the internet in general has democratized things so much. Knowledge. It's democratized creativity. You know, like you can get noticed for for creating things more easily than you could ever be noticed before. And I think to some extent it's created a sense of entitlement. You know, with the recent YouTube situation and unfortunate circumstances that led to a woman deciding that she wanted to travel to YouTube headquarters and take matters into her own hands and shoot some folks. What's unfortunately happening is I think a lot of folks are thinking that they are entitled to make a living on social media. You know, back when YouTube launched, and for the first 3 or 5 years, few, if any, people really made money on YouTube, you know, or social media platforms in general. There wasn't really a monetization system set up in the early days of social media. People weren't planning on making a living creating content on these mediums. At least there weren't systems in place created for them to do so in a sort of intentional way. But now, you know, YouTube, once you reach a certain number of subscribers and a certain number of minutes of video viewed on your channel, you can qualify to generate ad money, running ads on your videos. And unfortunately, unfortunately, a lot of people think that if they want to make a living on YouTube, they think they deserve to make a living on YouTube. And what they don't understand is that while YouTube has democratized creativity in a sense that anybody can create a YouTube video and post it online, YouTube has not democratized success on the internet. You can't just become successful creating something on the internet just because you want to. I would love to be able to live off of my blog and other efforts online, but I simply don't have the amount of attention or ad revenue one would need to make any sort of living. And what's bothersome to me is I think it's great that people can generate an income of some sort on the internet. I've done so myself with ads on my blog, and largely they've just been able to pay the costs that it takes to maintain a blog and things like that. But it's unfortunate to me that a lot of folks think that because they want to make a living being a well-known YouTuber or social media personality in general, that they deserve to. And that's a problem.
Well, let's talk about the woman who went into YouTube shooting, and she ended up taking her own life. But she was a 39-year-old woman living in San Diego and claims that YouTube said some of her exercise videos were too racy. Did you happen to follow that story at all?
Yeah, I followed the story. I'd never heard of her content before.
Right.
I think, you know, I followed the story a bit. I think it's fair to say there's a little bit of mental illness at play based on what I've been reading and problems that the family had been seeing beforehand and just things that they had noticed and had alerted others about. But I think what was interesting, despite that, and despite her actions that obviously make her lose some credibility just in general, I think what's interesting is it stems out of a very real complaint that a lot of YouTubers who don't plan to shoot up YouTube headquarters have with the company. A lot of her complaints that YouTube was squelching small creators, that YouTube was kind of making certain content difficult to find. I've heard that throughout the YouTube community. So a lot of her complaints, I think, were valid in that they're verified by a lot of other people. Now, that obviously doesn't justify doing anything near what she did. Maybe justifies a frustrated email to YouTube support or something like that. But yeah, what was interesting when I read that story was the first thing I thought of was that it was just sort of a random, you know, an act of violence against a well-known entity to get notoriety. And then when I saw, it was a creator who believed because she was a small YouTuber creating content that she thought YouTube maybe wouldn't be a big fan of or wouldn't support, she believed she was being specifically targeted and that her content was being specifically suppressed. I think part of that could just be a certain set of, you know, paranoia and thoughts that were problematic in general. But there is reason to believe that YouTube is suppressing certain kinds of content that they believe is not family friendly or content that they think is unhelpful, an unhelpful contribution to the community. And quite frankly, they have every right to do that. That's where I start to have a problem with YouTube creators and the complaints that they've been having is they think that just because YouTube used to be one way, that it's always has to be that way, and that somehow they're protected by some sort of unwritten law of the internet, that because the platform always worked in a certain way, it will always work that way to mm-hmm. their benefit. And unfortunately, platforms are always changing, and we have to adapt.
Yeah. Chris, is this hilarious duo of Diamond and Silk, are they they're getting censored by Facebook? What about that?
I've never heard of them before.
Can you really? Tell me about them? I've stumped you then. This is great. There are these two African-American women. They're pro-Trump pair. And they go on social media. They've got over a million followers. They were just on I saw them on Fox News over the weekend. And they are kind of loud and funny. And one does all the talking, and the other one just sits there and agrees with everything. It's actually visually pretty funny. And now Facebook is saying, no, you're a danger to the community. And they said, why? How are we a danger to the community? So it's
I mean, Not knowing about their, you know, not knowing about their specific situation, I think, you know, I'm also seeing, I just looked them up real quick. It also looks like they've asserted that YouTube has discriminated against them as well by demonetizing their channel,
mm-hmm.
And by their claims because of their support for Trump.
Right.
Facebook could be suppressing their content, but I work with Facebook a lot. Facebook's the platform I'm most familiar with. Facebook. The last type of content Facebook would ever want to suppress would be pro-Trump content. And why? Because a lot of their core users, driving a lot of their shares and interactions, are conservative Americans. So they would be hurting. They would be shooting themselves in the foot mm-hmm. if they were doing it. If they were trying to suppress content because it was pro-Trump. What they could be suppressing content for is for a number of other reasons. That Facebook suppresses content. If the people are asking for shares, if they're writing copy on their post that looks spammy, or if they're using a lot of foul language or things like that, I've seen suppression of content for all of those reasons.
Yeah.
And if they're doing those things in addition to whatever their content is about Trump, they may be misinterpreting the correlation between, oh, we're doing these things and our reach is going down or whatever. Same thing with YouTube. I know YouTube is demonetizing content, not because it's pro-Trump, but because of a lot of the ways people often communicate their pro-Trump views are worth demonetization in the eyes of YouTube, meaning foul language or crude communication and things like that. So those may be some of the reasons they're being demonetized or that their reach is being throttled on Facebook.
Okay, Chris, let me take a break. When I come back, I want to ask you how we can better control what captures our attention on social media and the internet. Be back with more of Chris Martin in just a minute. Minutes after the hour, I'm speaking to Chris Martin from Lifeway Research. MillennialEvangelical.com is his website. You can go check out his writings. And Chris, you know, one of the things that we need to do as believers is we need to know how to be smart about controlling what captures our attention and then what voices are going to be influencing us. I mean, I can be on the internet and all of a sudden I see something that says 21 things Gilligan's Island's producers didn't tell you. I go, well, I got to find out what that's all about. And 8 minutes later, I just wasted 8 minutes. I can't get back.
Yeah, that's such a great example. I use like a BuzzFeed 35 questions to decide if you're a Disney princess. That kind of stuff. it's cotton candy. It's cotton candy content all over the internet, and it's easy. I mean, you know, and there's a place for that.
Yeah.
You know, there's a place to have fun and be entertained and learn something new or whatever. I mean, there's a place for that, but it is easy to get distracted and end up wasting a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
I study social media a lot. It's a significant part of my job, both at Lifeway, but then also just kind of for fun. I mean, it's something that I've always been fascinated by ever since I was a teenager, just how social media works, what it says about us, what it says about us as communicators in general, beyond how we communicate on social media. What it says about our need for affirmation, our need for attention. But recently I was thinking about some of the, and to be fair, I think social media is valuable to some extent. I think there are ways that the church can use it to share the gospel with people, show people what it looks like to follow Jesus, and to use the gifts that God has given us to just serve other people. But the more I use social media, the older I get, the more it just kind of evolves and develops as a medium in general. I've only recently, I guess maybe in the last year, have become a lot more pessimistic about social media. I kind of always have an internal war with myself going on about the value of social media. I've long said it's kind of a neutral tool that can be used for good or for ill, depending on what you want to do with it. I'm starting to lean more toward it. It's more likely to be used for ill, and it takes a lot of intentional hard work to use it for good.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think about social media as a medium, I think there's a lot of opportunity, a lot of value, and we've seen that kind of in our world. But I think there are three significant limitations of social media as a medium. Quickly, one, social media deceives us. I think Neil Postman, in his 1985 book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, which has nothing to do with social media and everything to do with social media at the same time.
Right.
He says disinformation, we've been plagued by disinformation, and he says that it doesn't mean false information, but that it means misleading information or irrelevant information. And I think that through social media, we're consuming a sort of obscene amount of useless information that's leading us astray. Not that it's necessarily communicating false things, though obviously that's been a problem, but it's communicating things to us that just don't matter or are irrelevant to us. Number two, I think social media distracts us. You know, the number one way to attract anyone's attention with a tweet or anything like that is to throw breaking news on the front of it. And I think we just kind of get distracted. And as you described, you know, sort of cotton candy content on social media can get us distracted from what we need to be doing. And third, I think social media drowns us. One of the things that really bothers me, as much good as social media does, one of the things that bothers me is that people assume that, you know, if you haven't tweeted about it, you don't care about it. Or, you know, if you aren't talking about it on social media, you clearly are being passively ignorant about whatever the issue is of the day. And I think social media drowns us in information upon which we cannot be expected to act. All of the stuff we're seeing on social media, whether it's a hashtag that we're told that we need to care about, or a movement that we're told we need to tweet about, or whatever it is, I think we're not designed to care about the million topics that could be thrown at us at any given time on social media. And so I think we need to be careful about judging other people by, and you guys, you know, you may not do this. I see people my age doing this and others that, oh, if they're silent on social media about blank, they're obviously, you know, afraid to speak up, or they don't care, or whatever else. And I think social media can do a lot of good in the world. I just don't think that gauging someone's interaction around a topic, issue, or whatever else on social media is a fair way to evaluate how someone cares about something or if they're interested in acting upon it. So I think, you know, I study social media a lot. I'm engaged in it every day, but I think there are some really clear limits to what it can do and the positive effect it can have.
Mm-hmm. I've been bringing this up more than once already today, Chris, and that is, are we doing a better job of having discussions, or are we simply just having arguments?
Yeah, you know, every corner of the internet is going to be different on that. I can speak for myself that even just 2 or 3 years ago, I would get in arguments on social media for fun.
Oh, okay. It was a sport.
Yeah, really. I mean, it was like, hey, you know, you and I don't know each other. And even, I mean, and even if they were, they were well-meaning arguments, we would banter back and forth. I remember, like, multiple times making dinner, you know, I'd be making dinner with my wife in our apartment a few years ago and, like, tweeting back and forth with people about some particular theological issue, and with the understanding that, yeah, we're not going to hash this out, but it's fun. It's like fun to do, to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And I just got so tired of that. Because it would give me, you know, bad feelings toward people if I felt like they said something in a mean way. It's hard to interpret tone, things like that. So I think some folks about that, I know I've grown in that a little bit, but I think overall, both as a church community and a community, we could probably get, I don't know if social media is meant to carry constructive conversation.
Mm-hmm. Chris, thank you so much for being on the program. As always, look forward to our conversations, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, talk to you again soon.
You bet. 28 minutes after the hour, we'll take a short break and continue the show in just a minute. It's 32 minutes after the hour. We have some news to discuss, and then we're going to have a lively conversation with Dr. David Aikman, my foreign affairs specialist. Lots to talk about with him today. Be back in a minute.
When it seems like nothing's going right at home, when your teen is spinning out of control, ever feel like throwing up your hands and walking away? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Yeah, raising healthy kids is tough business, and I meet a lot of parents who are confused, tired, and frustrated. They long for easier days. Well, there's no one who can wave a magic wand over your household and make it better, but there is one who can change you from the inside out. So when you feel like giving up, it's the perfect time to depend on God. So instead of getting hassled over the trials at home, turn to the only one who can help you. See this as a grand adventure for God to do His greatest work in you.
Learn how to navigate your child's turbulent teen years with Mark Gregson's free course. Get instant access by visiting freeparentingcourse.com.
My name is Bond, James Bond.
And of course, that theme song belongs to Dr. David Aikman, foreign affairs correspondent, friend of Faith Radio, best-selling author, former professor at Patrick Henry. Does it all. He's with us this morning. Hello, David.
Good morning. Nice to hear from you.
Thank you so much. All right. Is it obvious that Bashar Assad is like now an official war criminal?
Well, I think the evidence is very compelling that it was he or his regime that launched these barrel bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Because to launch barrel bombs, you have to have helicopters and so forth. And the knowledge of what's going on in the skies over Syria is clear to at least three other countries in the area, Russia, obviously the U.S. and Israel. And second, it's a repeat of what was done last year, which led both to the bombing of that Syrian airbase by cruise missiles, and also the original line in the sand warning by President Obama that never actually happened. So it's the same stuff, the same symptoms, the same physical manifestations of people who are in the line of fire of these barrel bombs. And it also seems to tie into the whole Syrian policy of absolutely exterminating this opposition by scaring the daylights out of them, and so they have to leave the area.
Mm-hmm. David, maybe just for context's sake, we can go back to what Syria did that caused President Obama to say, I'm going to draw this line in the sand, which he never apparently acted on.
Well, that's right. Well, what happened is that there was an incident of barrel bombings with the effects of gas, maybe sarin gas, maybe chlorine, in another Syrian town, what was it, 3 years ago, mm-hmm. I think. And President Obama said the evidence from observers and people who've gone in and from doctors in the area is overwhelming that poison gas was used. And that President Obama used that basically as a landmark, or what he called a line in the sand, that the Syrians were not allowed to cross again without serious consequences. Well, of course, they crossed it several times, and nothing happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even get a slap on the wrist. And I think one of the reasons that the stakes are much higher this time is that the United States seems to be as outraged as many other countries is, and through President Trump has threatened a sort of retaliatory action. But the other thing is that the Russians are absolutely solidly behind the Syrians, defending them against charges of using chemical and gas warfare. The Iranians are completely behind the Syrians. And the Russians have hinted that if the Americans do a retaliatory assault on Syrian military facilities, then the Russians might well respond. And that raises the international stakes seriously higher.
When you say the Russians might respond, what might they do?
Well, they could sort of, in theory, react with their own military strikes on some of the United States naval forces in the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a very, very serious change in the equation between the U.S. and Russia. Because when the U.S. in the past responded to these airstrikes, for example, against that air base with missiles ordered by Trump last year, the Russians were warned in advance not to have their personnel out abroad on the air base, so no Russians were killed. And similarly, the Israelis apparently gave an identical warning to the Syrians or to the Russians, saying, we don't want to kill any of your people, but we are doing a retaliatory attack, which we feel obliged to. So be alert. Don't have your personnel on the ground when we strike, because mm-hmm. we'll possibly kill them.
David, John Bolton starts today as President Trump's new national security advisor. Busy day for him. What might be the response from the White House regarding all this?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think Bolton is assumed to be a hawk by many observers, as indeed Pompeo, who is in charge of the CIA. So I think it's likely that if Trump is inclined to have a retaliation against Syria because of these gas bombings, that John Bolton will probably reinforce that viewpoint and support him. Well, obviously, as national security advisor, he has to support the president. But I think his own instincts for a sharp reaction when it's possible against Russian and other sort of dangerous doing overseas has a history behind it, and I think that's clearly his personality and his record.
Mm-hmm. If the U.S., David, were going to retaliate, would the smartest thing to do would be to take out the air power that Syria has?
Yes, in many people have said that you want to try and do a strike that shows that you're just going to disarm Syrian air power by bombing all of the operational bases available to Syrian aircraft in the country. I mean, the base T-4, which the Israelis retaliated against yesterday is one of the few operational bases in Syria which has not only Russian planes and Russian personnel there, but also Iranian. So I think it's very likely that if the United States responded with a retaliatory attack, it would focus on the bases in Syria which it can get to.
Mm-hmm. All right, David, let me take a little break. When I come back, I've got many more things to ask you, one of which is this this cyber attack in Iran that was apparently left by someone from the U.S., or the U.S. flag was left on their screens. I want to talk about that. Speaking to Dr. David Aikman, 14 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be right back. Minutes until the top of the hour, I have on our studio line Dr. David Aikman. David, Iran was hit by a global cyber attack, and the result was little U.S. flags on their screens. Was that some 17-year-old kid from Pasadena?
You know, it's a very funny story because it has humor to it, and yet it indicates the effectiveness of hackers that actually work for our side. You may remember a few years ago that the Iranian nuclear program was sabotaged by a very subtle hacking attack that disabled most of their computer operations in the nuclear program. And the virus that they used at the time was called Stuxnet. And Stuxnet appeared to be something concocted by both American and Israeli hackers to disrupt further progress on Iran's nuclear program. This certainly sounds to me very much in the same vein, a combination of chutzpah and humor. So it's really interesting.
I do find it very interesting, and every time I hear of cyber attack, I never think of the U.S. doing it. I always think of it coming from some foreign country to the U.S.
Well, that, of course, there's a lot of that that's been going on, but at least we apparently have some bad guys on our side.
Yeah, no doubt. So, David, I had a chance to talk to Dr. Adam Carrington this morning on the program about the China and the trade wars, but I'd love to get your perspective. Is Beijing ready to hit back?
Yes, I think it is. But in many ways, this is a game of chicken between the U.S. and China. China realizes that it stepped over the bar too much in the degree of dumping that it carried out to build up these huge trade deficits in the United States trade with China. And I think it recognized that, as well as the fact that it's been stealing U.S. intellectual property. But at the same time, China doesn't want to be made to appear to have lost face by giving way. So what both sides have to do is to figure out at what point they can plink without sort of appearing to back down in their face-off. So far, nothing disastrous seems to have happened, but the Chinese are definitely digging their heels in.
I think it's going to be interesting to watch this thing play out, only because what I hear from the Trump administration is that China has never been playing fair, and also there's a $500 billion trade deficit. And to me, if they're not playing fair, I'm glad there's a president that's going to step up to try to make it better.
Well, many Americans think that, and the president has a lot of grassroots support for his play tough policy with China. But there are parts of the American economy that could be damaged by a Chinese retaliatory response in terms of putting tariffs on American exports into China, things like agricultural produce and meat and so forth, of which China imports a lot from the United States. So it's a very tricky issue. This is one of those cases, I think, where a sort of subtle degree of head nodding and blinking would be able to prevent this trade war leading into an absolute catastrophe, and yet at the same time having some effectiveness in reducing the deficit that we have with China.
Mm-hmm. You know, David, I've been a little stuck ever since I heard you casually start speaking Russian last week or the week before. And I was thinking about, I have a friend who speaks Russian, so I had him translate what you said. And it, apparently all you said is, I'd like a double mac and cheese. So that did take some of the punch away.
Yes.
But I'd like to just...
I first went to McDonald's in Pushkin Square back in 1988, the first time it opened.
Oh, funny.
You know what happened there? People were taking home these styrofoam mugs in which they'd been served coffee and drink and so forth.
I'm sure.
They were taking everything back from McDonald's that they could lay their hands on. It was a classic case of pillage.
Total, yeah. But I was thinking about intellectual abilities. Now, as a retired professor, you saw a lot of bright students in your class, and maybe you saw some students that were not as bright as the others. But the intellectual
right.
ability is
yes.
something that we seldom talk about. We talk about athletes and people who are really good at something, and nobody says, well, try harder and you might be as good as, fill-in-the-blank athlete. But when it comes to intellectual ability, the only thing we ever heard as a kid was you need to apply
right.
yourself more.
The point about intellectual ability has been made very persuasively by Jordan Peterson, the Canadian University of Toronto mm-hmm. psychologist, who has been fighting an ongoing battle with his government about language that he should or shouldn't use. And he points out that intellectual abilities almost invariably convey the kind of talent that people need to succeed in almost any endeavor. But there are other assets, there are other characteristics too that people need. For example, how much people are willing to be unpleasant to get ahead. And there are various ways of measuring this. And the sad facts are that people who do not have very pleasing personalities that get along comfortably with anybody tend to get ahead quicker than those who have more cozy personalities. So put that into the mix and try to figure out what you could make of it.
I love it. David, thank you so much for being a guest. I always look forward to talking to you. Thank you again and again, and have a wonderful week.
Thank you, Paul, and the same to you.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
It is 4 minutes till the top of the hour. We will be back to wrap up the big show in just a minute. The Early Morning Late Show on Faith Radio, you just might find yourself saying, I can't wait to get up early. Yeah, of course, we're kidding. Thanks to Dr. David Aikman. Always a pleasure to speak to him. Chris Martin, great hour two. Spring Share starts tomorrow. We're very excited around here. It's always such a fun time to connect the listeners, to remind them that we are listener-supported, and that without the support of listeners, we're in deep trouble. So thank you so much for listening and supporting the station. We've been around since 1948. We hope to be around a lot longer than that. So thank you again. As the psalmist says in 103, he will not always accuse, nor will he harbor his anger forever. He does not treat us as our sins deserve or repay us according to our iniquities. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his love for those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Go out with bold confidence, knowing you are forgiven, you are loved, and we care about you here. See you in the morning. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.